Well, we're here in Wayland, Missouri with Keith Courtney, and he was a long-time employee of, or worked at, the Keokuk Union Depot, and we have a lot of questions to ask him in order to preserve these things out of depot history. I'm here with Janet Smith, president of the Keokuk Union Depot Foundation, and my name's Richard Leonard. So, Mr. Courtney, thanks so much for having us in your home here, because we got a lot of questions to ask you, and we know you've got some great stories to tell. First of all, let me ask you this. When did you start working at the depot?
I went there the first time in 1963. Mm-hmm. I was working as an agent at Ipava, Illinois, and they closed the station, and I had to bump in somewhere. And Keokuk was close to home, so I bumped in and on second shift, I don't know, 3 to 11 or 4 to 12, at Keokuk Union Depot.
And Ipava, that was on the CB&Q.
Yes, I was a CB&Q employee.
I see.
But when we went to work for the at the depot, we were like on loan to the Keokuk Union Depot Company.
That was my question, whether you worked for the depot company as
yes,
such. Did the depot company ever actually show up? I mean, they were made up of representatives of the different railroads that came into Keokuk, but did they ever hold meetings or anything?
By Iowa law, at the time, they had to have a corporation meeting, annual meeting, once a year on the premises. So every year, each railroad, the five railroads, the Wabash, I think that they didn't show up, but they let the TP&W vote their share.
I see.
And the CB&Q had two shares, and Rock Island, TP&W, and Wabash, each one had one share. So the representatives would show up for the annual meeting, which was a big deal. A while before the meeting started, I would get a big packet through the mail, and it was the minutes of the meeting that were typed up a month ahead of time. So they would come in and they'd kind of go look at the meetings and sign off on it. That's all it amounted to. But it fell in the law, satisfied the law.
So in ahead of time, what they were going to be supposedly discussing at the meeting, they probably didn't discuss very much.
No, the depot meeting actually was very short, and then they talk about other things.
Okay. I meant to ask you, who was at the depot before you? Who did you take the place of?
I actually bumped a young guy by the name of Bobby Miller. I thought I was bumping a different guy, but he had already been bumped. So Bobby Miller bumped him, and then I bumped Bobby Miller. So.
Okay. Although you said you were on loan to the depot company, you were actually paid by the CB&Q. Is that?
No, I got a check from the Union Depot Company.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. My seniority went on the CB&Q, but I had nothing to do with the CB&Q outside of that paycheck. I mean, outside of the seniority. I was paid by the Union Depot Company. I've still got check stubs from them. And that went on until, I think it was after the Keokuk Junction took over the depot, then went back to the CB&Q.
That's fascinating. And so what was your actual job title?
The title was operator, second shift operator.
Okay.
But you were operator, ticket seller, baggage handler, mail handler, janitor, whatever took, you know. And a lot of telegraph, a lot of telegraph.
So you were the agent, really?
Well, I was just the second trick operator. The day man was actually in charge of the station.
Oh,
the ticket
I see.
Office.
Now, who was that?
That was Gene Carricker. I think his name was Ronald Eugene Carricker. Gene Carricker, C-A-R-R-I-K-E-R. And he went from Keokuk to be the agent at Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And I don't know what happened to him after that.
You were on duty nights?
Yes, a second shift for a long time until Gene Carricker, when he left, then I bid in the first trick job. That's when I became the ticket agent.
Do you remember that year?
No, I really don't.
Okay. Right.
I sold a lot of tickets on second shift, you know, but I was not the ticket agent.
Were you also the superintendent?
Yes, they made me. See, Gene Carricker was a superintendent while he was there. When he left, they made me the superintendent. And that was a fabulous job. You got $35 a month and got to clean the restrooms.
Okay. So you actually wore three hats, superintendent, operator, and agent,
right,
all that time.
We had a third shift back then, too.
Okay.
And I can't remember for sure the guy's name that worked that. Then they cut that out and split the shifts, you know. When after they lost the passenger trains in 1967, they didn't need us there around the clock anymore.
Did the other railroads have their own freight agents?
The TP&W, of course, they had their office across and the CB&Q had their freight office, and the Rock Island had their freight office. The Wabash never had either. The Rock Island handled the Wabash business on a contract.
Was the Rock Island office the building that was across the street from the depot?
No, it was...
Downriver?
It was just downriver, down across Bank Street.
Yes, that's what I think I meant.
But then the Rock Island eventually moved their freight office up into the depot.
That would have happened after the last passenger train.
Oh, yes. I don't remember what year it was.
But well, we got pictures of the partition there taken in 1969, so it was at least between 67 and 69?
Yeah, probably was, yes.
Okay.
And what room was that partition in?
They partitioned off the area for the Rock Island Freight Office, and that was in the downstream end of the waiting room.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so as you went up to the ticket counter, which nobody would have done because no tickets were being sold, that partition was to your right, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, we still sold tickets after they quit running passenger trains. Oh, yes. You could go to, I could sell you a ticket, you go to Burlington and get on a train right in. And that lasted for, I don't know, maybe a year or something, maybe 2 years. Mm-hmm.
Well, as operator, you signed the clearance form for the last passenger train, and that was April 4, 1967.
April 7th, I believe it was.
April 7, you're right.
Yes, 1967. Number 15, the Zephyr Rocket.
It was apparently had lost its name by that time.
Probably. And that last train, he had two or three cars with it. That's all there was.
Well, did any passengers get off or on it?
I don't remember of any passengers because the train terminated at Burlington that night. It only went as far as Burlington.
Oh, it didn't go all the way to Minneapolis.
No, uh-uh.
There was a southbound train supposed to come through about 3 a.m., but that didn't come?
No, that was number 8. That was the other side of the Zephyr Rocket, and it did not come.
So the northbound run was the very last one.
Uh-huh.
On the clearance form that you signed, there's a couple of train orders that you indicated, Order 177 and Order 179. What did those mean?
Well, every train order, see the dispatcher at Hannibal, he'd call me on the phone and he'd take copy of this order, and I would write it down and copy it for delivery to the train.
Mm-hmm.
But he numbered them consecutively, starting at maybe number 100 or 200 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I wanted to deliver the order to the train, this clearance card, all the trains at Keokuk had to have a clearance Form A before they could leave Keokuk. Well, I would look and see, okay, I've got two or three or five orders or whatever for this train, and I'd list them on there and make sure. Then I would repeat this, tell the dispatcher, I'd say, clear number 15 with two orders, number 177 and 179.
I see.
And he would check his records and made sure that's all orders he had put out for that train. So the dispatcher was checking it, I was checking it, and then the conductor and engineer would check and made sure that, did we actually get both of those orders? They were orders. They told the train what to do, and there was no deviating from it. When I gave order number 179 to that train, it told him to do something, and he had to do it.
Like to proceed to Fort Madison, say?
Yes, or it might tell him to wait at Fort Madison until 10:15 p.m., you know, or maybe to meet a train up there at Montrose or something. Actually, there were three different forms of this clearance, and I don't have the other two. There was a Form A and a Form B and a Form C. The Form A, of course, this is what we have here. The Form B was if we'd lose communications. If I would have had these two orders for that train and I lost all communications with the dispatcher, I could look at those orders and say, okay, I will deliver them to the train, and it would be on a Form B. And I would say, I have two orders for you, number so-and-so and so-and-so, and it would say wire failure clearance on it. And then the train crew, it would be up to them to look at those orders and say, okay, now what do we have the right to do now? And then after we got communications back, I would go back in and tell the dispatcher what I had done. So that way you could go ahead and move the train. We did very seldom use them. I only used them maybe two or three times in my whole career. But very seldom, but it was an emergency thing. Then we had a Form C, which was a pink form. And down here where it says block, I would write in there Form C. That way, that would tell the train that there is another train ahead of you in the block between here and the next open station. You know, you got to watch out for this other train. Now, we could do that if there's a freight train ahead of a passenger train.
Mm-hmm.
We could tell a passenger train there's a freight train ahead of you. But we could not tell a freight train there's a passenger ahead of you. You could not let anybody behind the passenger train. That was a form A, B, and C. It was a three clearance forms.
This is great information.
We also had orders that would be a higher numbered order, like maybe an 800 series or something, that they were standing orders. Like they had high water down to Alexandria. All trains that were going to go through there, would tell them to reduce speed, or if there was men working along the track. And all trains were going to have, so we had standing orders, and I'd have a whole bunch of them hanging on a hook to deliver to all trains.
Which brings up another question. We have a photo taken in 69 through the window into the ticket office, and it shows a train order hoop propped up against the opposite wall.
Right.
So did you have to go out and hand up orders?
Oh, yes,
on the
many,
hoop?
Many times.
Uh-huh.
Many times. And it was a lot of fun when you go out there and it's cold and it's snowing and it's or pouring down rain. And you're out there, you take that train order hoop and you hold it down to where it would reach the end of the ties. And then you hold it up about that angle and the train engine would come along and the fireman or engineer or brakeman, whoever, would reach out and put his arm through that hook and
right.
take the order. Then when the caboose come along, the way car as we called it, then you had to hold it out like this because he was down lower. And sometimes they would miss it.
That was my next question. What happened when they missed?
Then they had to come back and get it.
To stop and back up.
Oh, I had that happen down at Macon. Two nights in a row, I stopped the hottest freight train on the line because the caboose missed his order. Oh. And they went out and down across on the Sherrick River bottom and had to back way back up to Macon to get his order. Two nights in a row.
No, what did they do? Pull the air to tell the engineer to stop?
Oh, yeah, they'd have to, they had to stop him and back him up. And the second time it happened, I told the dispatcher what had happened. He said, you got 2 days off coming now, don't you? And he said, yeah. I said, yeah, I sure do. He said, then maybe I can get that damn train through Macon, he said. Yeah, I missed a lot of them. One night, I was working at LaGrange. On the extra board, the engineer come through, I gave him his order, the caboose come through, and I got him too close, and there's a nail sticking out there. And the string caught on the nail, and they didn't stop the train, they went on, because he knew the engineer had his, and so they went on up to Canton, and they were going to stop there anyway, and that's when the conductor got his order, took him off, hanging on that nail.
They were hanging on the side of the way car.
Yeah, but at Keokuk, we didn't have much of that trouble because they were all going slow over there. You know, mm-hmm.
They all expected to get orders at Keokuk. Right?
Oh, yes. They had to have a clearance to leave.
There was no semaphore or order board.
Yeah.
So
all trains had to have a clearance.
They knew
form.
They had to get orders there,
yes.
regardless.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And passenger trains had to come in and register. All trains had to register at Keokuk. We had a book there. And they had to register their train, their arrival, departure, or whether they're carrying signals or not, whether it was the first section or whatever. Or they could give me a little ticket, and I would put them on the register. But they all had to register at Keokuk. So the conductor on the passenger trains, he'd come in and fill out the register and everything while we were doing the mail and express. But I'd hook up the orders to the engineer. The conductor would come in and get his own orders.
I see.
And then, of course, a lot of the longer passenger trains had a flagman on them. And if the flagman, he might be up in the middle of the train, so then you had to hand up three sets of orders.
The trains weren't that long at the very end. You said just a few cars?
Yes. Yeah. Most of the passenger trains that ran through Keokuk would be, maybe 8 or 10 cars, something like that, 6 to 10.
And when you started in 63, and I haven't looked up the schedules, but there must have been two or three trains each way.
There were four trains each way. There was a Zephyr Rocket from mm-hmm. St. Louis to Minneapolis, both ways. So, and then there was number 1 and number 12. That ran from St. Louis to Burlington. And 43 and 44 ran from St. Louis to Burlington. And then we had 41 and 42 that started at Hannibal and went to Burlington and went on to Chicago.
It wasn't the Mark Twain Zephyr, but one of the other early Burlington Zephyrs.
Well, not when I started, it wasn't. They just put anything on it.
I see. Too bad we don't have those trains now.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
And airlines are so crowded now, you wait hours and hours to get on, and maybe they cancel flight. Why don't we run passenger trains? I don't remember very seldom ever canceling a passenger train through here, on account of snow or anything. And there was always room.
Well, let me ask you, I think you mentioned you sold a lot of tickets for that excursion in 1963 when the last steam engine came through the CB&Q.
In fact, that one came through there more than once. And I had the 4960 was the engine,
right.
And I've sold tickets on them several times. Plus, the Rock Island ran an excursion train into Keokuk one time from Eldon, Iowa to Keokuk. They had sack lunches and ate their lunches in the depot waiting room.
Do you remember the year?
I'd hate to tell you the year. I think it was after we quit running passenger trains, so I'm going to say it would have been in the late 60s probably.
So the picture we have that was taken in May of 63, 4960 at the depot, that might not have been the very last steam engine through.
That could have been. I don't. Well, this paper says it's the last hurrah.
That's because that's what I said.
Yeah.
Or that's the title. Maybe that is the
and
title.
And it very well could have been. Because that 4960, they toured that thing around quite a little bit over the system.
Oh, yeah. It's now in Arizona at the Grand Canyon Railway.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, still exists. But you sold a lot of tickets. The picture shows a big crowd there.
Oh, yes. It was nothing to sell 300 tickets on an excursion train. Lots and lots of them.
And all getting on at Keokuk?
Yeah. Well, most of them did. Now, I worked as an operator at West Quincy one time in the spring of the year, and they were running student excursion trains, special trains of students, and baseball excursion in Kansas City and St. Louis. Number 56 ran from Chicago to Kansas City through West Quincy. One night that number 56 left West Quincy heading to Kansas City. There were six sections of number 56. And, train orders. I had train orders everywhere. I had them piled up on the desk. I lit a cigar at midnight. At 8 o'clock in the morning, I was still chewing it on. I hadn't had time to smoke it. The yardmaster down there called me cigars ever after that. I was cigars. Oh, yes. They used to run two or three or more sections of a train.
So if you worked at West Quincy for a while, was this during the time you were at Keokuk?
No, it was probably, I was on the extra board, and I worked at different places around it to start off with. And I worked at West Quincy then. And then before I went to Keokuk, I worked at West Quincy. But, when I left Keokuk, I had to end up my career down there for a year and a half, which I hated it. But,
I didn't know that. So you didn't retire directly from Keokuk?
No. They cut my job off. There was no more jobs I could hold in Keokuk. Mm-hmm. And I had to go somewhere because I wasn't retirement age yet. So I went down to West Quincy to a nothing job, janitor and driving train crews around, and I hated every minute of it.
Was it better than the superintendent's job, though?
Well, I don't think so, because I still had to clean restrooms. But at the depot, I liked selling tickets. And when I first went there, I probably wasn't real good at it. But I got to where I was pretty good at selling tickets.
And why did you like it?
It was just a challenge of trying to give you come down to buy, you want to take a trip out west and circle around. By taking my time, I could give you a whale of a trip, and it wouldn't cost you. Like, I could sell you a ticket on the Santa Fe from Fort Madison to Los Angeles, and I could throw in a free side trip to the Grand Canyon. And it was things like this I could do, and I loved doing it.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you were kind of like a travel planner for people.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. It was right in the tariffs and everything. You have your free side trip on a bus up to Grand Canyon. Well, why not give it to you? You know. And I like doing it.
Do you remember this excursion on the TP&W in 1980?
In 1980.
That's the date that I was given.
Well, it probably was. And I don't really remember it. I was probably there. But I don't really remember it. A lot of people were there.
That was during the day, but you went on to days eventually. So all this time you were, at the earlier part, you were using the telegraph
heavily. Yeah, we had phones for the dispatcher it was like a party line. We could call anywhere on the system, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we still used the telegraph a lot for all the railroad communication wires and different things. We used the telegraph at that. And we had a relay office at Hannibal, and I would get on the wire, and I would send to the relay office down at Hannibal for maybe an hour, hour and a half. I'd have all this stack of stuff to send to him and on telegraph. And then he'd have a stack to send to me. So it was nothing to unusual at all to spend at least 3 hours out of the 8 hour shift on a telegraph, and sometimes more than that. And then down at the relay office at Hannibal, they got to hiring kids that didn't know how to telegraph. You have to get on the telephone and do it on the telephone. And I hated that. I loved telegraph. Always did love the telegraph. And I got pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the best I've ever seen. That Gene character that was the day man over at Keokuk, he was the best I ever saw. He could sit there and send it on the telegraph key, writing something with his other hand and talking to you while he's doing it. Me, I'm a one-track man. Okay. If I was on the telegraph and you walked in and said good morning, I'd have to stop, say good morning, and then go back to it.
Yeah, we've got this article about the last telegraph at the depot in 1970,
yeah.
Late 78 maybe, or early 79.
You got a copy of the mm-hmm. paper there. The article was basically the way I told them. There's a few little things in it that didn't amount much. But the mm-hmm. basically, it was a true article. They had removed the telegraph before that. So I set up my set there just to make it look good, you know.
So actually, in the picture, this is not actually in service at that time.
That's
right.
That
was a post
yeah.
picture. Okay. So they must have removed the telegraph in 78, because the article, or seven, maybe late 77, rather. Because the article is January 78.
Yeah, it could be. I don't remember. All I knew, one day the lineman come in and said, I'm taking all this stuff out. I said, what are you going to do with it? Well, he said, I got to send it in. I bet it never got any further in his truck.
Was it copper wire?
I would love to have had the old sounder and uh-huh. everything. And I've got my practice set, but I'd like to have had the old original. And they had that, it was on an arm, you know, you could move it out around and get closer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Now, as far as we can tell from pictures, they put this big, tall radio antenna up next to the depot, I think in 1969 or by November of 69.
Something like that. When they started using the radios.
Right.
The first radios they put in, I had one in the office and I could communicate with the trains locally. But that's all. I was working over there one time. And number 43, about, I don't know, 1:32 o'clock in the afternoon, he left going north, and he took off, and I went in and told the dispatcher what time he arrived and departed and everything. Thought nothing of it, normal. Pretty soon he called me on the radio. The train called me on the radio. He says, you need to notify the dispatcher. We just hit a barge. I said, you just did what? We just hit a barge. I said, how in the world did you hit? Are you in the river or is a barge on the railroad? Well, it turned out that the barge had washed the waves and wind had pushed it up to where it was up fouling the track, and they hit it right up around up above the dam. So I got on the phone, and I'm telling the dispatcher, I said, number 43 just called in and said he just hit a barge up north of town. He said, he did what? That didn't happen very often, you know.
That antenna was very high. Was it high because of being down below the bluff?
Yes, and see, with that, the dispatcher could dial in that radio system mm-hmm. and use that tower, and then he could talk to the trains. And that's what was the start of killing the train order operations. The dispatcher could talk directly to the trains.
We think that tower went down by the end of 1992, but were you still working there when it came
no,
down?
No, it was still there when I left.
Okay.
And I can't remember for sure what year they moved us out of the depot. We were out before the 93 flood, so I want to say it was like 91 or 92 when we moved out and they built the other building down below, and I went down there.
Down below, across the other side of the tracks?
No, it was on down there by the Coast Guard.
Okay.
Yeah, the Burlington Northern put up a building down there.
Oh, yeah. I think they still park their yard units next
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, uh-huh. So I was at the depot for right at 30 years, right close to it, I don't know, 28 or 30 years.
The waiting room was then partitioned off for the different railroad's freight agents after the last passenger train in 67.
Yeah, then the Rock Island put their freight office in there.
Okay.
Then they pulled out when they went bankrupt and pulled out. Then later on, the Burlington Northern put their freight office down in there, in the other end of the waiting room. That's when they lowered the ceiling and did all that, knocked holes in the walls for the air conditioning.
So the picture that we have is before that happened. It's only the downriver end that's partitioned off. And then later, they lowered the ceiling until the KJ rebuilt the whole wing.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yes. What happened to the train's bulletin board?
There's an interesting theory about that, or a story.
Okay.
I didn't want it. I didn't collect old railroad stuff. And why do I want with this big old board, you know? But I was listening on this party line company phone line one day, and I heard an official of the Burlington Railroad call the local agent. He said, I want you to do something for me. Okay, he'd do anything for an official, you know. I said, what is it? He said, well, I want you to go down to the depot and get that board off the side of the ticket office down there. I want that. He said, I want you to go down there and get that. Okay, I'll do it. I thought, well, you're not either if I could help it, because I didn't like either one of them. And I went out there, got my screwdriver. I went out there. I'm going to take that board down and hide it. I went out there, and it was gone. And I didn't even know how long it had been. I didn't pay attention to the thing. It might have been gone for 2 or 3 weeks, and I wouldn't have known it. So I don't know who. I always suspected who got it, but I don't know where it went.
All we have is a picture.
Yeah, and I always suspected that I knew who got it, but I can't. I didn't really try to find out too much, mm-hmm. because I didn't care as long as that official didn't get it.
Okay, all right. I think you have related in the past about this hopper car that got away from the TW and TPNW track gang. Tell us about that.
Well, I was sitting in there. It was during lunch hour. The section men were all up there in the depot eating lunch. And I was in the office in there. I don't know, eat my lunch where I'd fit it anyway. But I heard this clickety-click, clickety-click, clickety-click. That's odd, you know. So I got up and looked out in the window and see what it was. Well, I seen this hopper car go by over on the main line, the CB&Q, the main line, which would have been a number 5 track that, I think. Anyway, just clickety-click, it's going. Well, I called out to the yard office. I said, hey, have you got a switch engine up here at the depot kicking cars around? He said, no, they're both down the yard. I said, well, there's a hopper car headed your way, and it's gaining speed as it goes. I said, it's really moving down the hill. I told you. I said, if you can, get your switch in here to get out of the way. Get everybody out of the way. I said, it's loose. I don't know where it come from. Anyway, I don't know what he did down there, but the section foreman had his pickup there, and one of the section hand, Bill Stinson, jumped in the back end of that truck, and the foreman took off down the track, and he got down there, caught up with that car over on the road down along the river, and the section man jumped out, went over, jumped on the side of that car. Well, the brake was on the other side, but he jumped on that car, just about went under the car, and he got over and went over the drawbar and crawled up and got that handbrake and got that car stopped. Only casualty was he lost his glasses and got his glasses broke. Well, it turned out the TPNW, they had to call it a work train. It was a crane outfit over, and they were working on the hill over there up above Hamilton, and they had this car sitting up there. They were unloading it, and they had the wheels chalked and the handbrakes. Didn't set the handbrake. Anyway, the car got loose, and by the time they noticed it, the car took off. Well, they tried to catch it with an old crane. It didn't move very fast. That car came down and crossed 2 highway crossings over to Hamilton to get to the bridge, came across the bridge, which luckily was not open to the drawbar, and came over and came down across Main Street and Johnson Street and Bank Street crossings and never hurt nothing. It was amazing. And the car was only, it was partly unloaded in one end, which makes it a lot more dangerous. The only thing they did, they had to split the switch up there at the north end to get over on our main line, and they just sprung a point a little bit, section moving up there, and adjusted that, didn't take nothing. That's the only thing that hurt. And the TPNW bought that section man a new, brand new pair of glasses.
Right.
And we're glad to do it.
They were.
Yeah, that was an amazing thing that happened.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Tell us about Herman the Cockroach.
Oh, yes. Harry Fogan, he was the last full-time employee of the depot. He was a baggage agent. And his only seniority he held was with the Keokuk Union Depot. And Harry and I worked down there at night together. And we were sitting out in the waiting room there one time, a little round table. We were eating our lunch. And we'd sat out there, and this big old cockroach, he was 2 inches long, big sucker. He'd come out there, and he'd wander around out, or we'd throw him scraps. Mm-hmm. And we'd feed him, you know, he's our pet. And we'd watch him about every night. And one night was sitting there eating, the old cockroach, he's out there playing around out there. We've been feeding him. This guy walks in the waiting room door and come up there and says, look at that, stomp taught him.
And that was the end of...
That ended the cockroach.
That was the end of Herman. Yeah. Oh, my.
Oh, yeah.
Any other anecdotes you'd like to relay?
Some of the things I wouldn't want to tell on recording, be recorded telling, because
there was things that happened down there that were terrible. There was nothing really unusual. The time the drunk got off the train, off number 15 there, Zephyr Rocket going north, that drunk got off the coach, and he started up the platform, and I guess he didn't make it very far, and he fell. Hmm. And he fell down between the platform and the rail, and nobody saw him. And the train left town and never heard him a bit. We saw this guy laying out there. Well, we got him up on his feet. He's drunk as a skunk. And he fell. It's a wonder he didn't get arms and legs and stuff cut off. Nobody knew it.
Was that train on track one or track two?
He was on track one.
Track one, yeah. Right by the platform.
Yeah. It used to be interesting when we had two platforms, you know, mm-hmm. brick platforms, and we'd have, like, number one would be late, so he'd be coming in at about the same time that number eight going south. Number one was going north, number eight going south. And so they'd both be coming in about the same time. So we'd have to have the mail and baggage and stuff for number one. They'd put him over on number two track over there. So we'd have to have all his stuff over there. And the stuff over for number eight, a lot of mail baggage on number eight, we'd have that on number one. But the only problem was, the stuff is there, but we're not. We can't work but one train at a time. So number one would just have to wait till we got number eight worked. But a lot of time when it was snow and ice and stuff, it was a job getting those baggage trucks moved over there, you know, getting them over there. And I worked down there at nights when there would be blizzard going on and terrible, and we couldn't keep the platform clean. And that was the baggage man's job. Harry Fogelman's job was to clean the platform. And he'd be out there pushing and trying and working and trying to get the platform clean enough we could work the mail and the express and the passengers. And we've even had to have the train pull up and let the passengers off up there by the depot door. Because either that or wade snow a foot deep. And I used to go out when I had time. If I didn't have anything I had to be in the office for, I'd go out to help Harry. He said, well, nobody else ever did that. Well, I couldn't see that old man out there working all by himself. One time the section men left their tractor down there, and it had a great big brush on the front of it, revolving brush, little Ford tractor. And I, of course, I'm a farm boy, you know, I knew how to run a tractor. And snow was bad. It was a blizzard going on, and Harry just couldn't keep anything caught up. I said, no, I'll fix it. I went out here and I fired up that Ford tractor and I'd make a swipe up through there and I'd throw that snow airplane. Most of it would go right straight up the air and right down the back of my neck. That's where it went. Anyway, I got there and I had her going good, you know, and then I had to go back in the office and get ticket sales or whatever for the train coming. And I told Harry, I says, I'll show you how to do this. You go ahead and run this thing. Well, I showed him, and pretty soon Harry come in. He said, I ain't running no more. I said, what's the matter, Harry? He said, I dropped off the edge of the platform, and I'm stuck out there. Oh. He said, and I'm blocking the track. So I went out there, and I'm wiggling around and everything and using the brakes and stuff, and I got it back up on the platform. Harry would never run it again. He would never touch it more.
Do you have any other questions, Janet?
I don't. I'm impressed with, as always, with Richard's knowledge of the trains coming through, and it's been fun, lots of fun listening to you.
I was laying awake the other night, which I do once in a while, and I got to trying to think of this book of rules. When I went to telegraph school up in Minneapolis, I had to memorize this book. The old instructor would say, what does this rule say? And I'd have to tell him, word for word. And I memorized this book, and I got to try to think the definitions of different things. What is a train? What is an engine? And it tells all this, the definition right in front of it, and I'm trying to remember what the definitions all are. You know what an engine is? It's a unit, or more than one unit, mm-hmm. operated from a single control used in train or yard service.
And a train?
A train is an engine, or more than one engine, coupled with or without car, displaying a marker or markers.
And what is a marker?
It was a red light mm-hmm. at the end of the train. See, if I was out there, say, I'm working down at Canton at night, and a train comes flying by there, and I go in and I tell the dispatcher that, oh, number 80, whatever, by at a certain time. Well, number 80 is not by unless he's got that red light on him, because he might have come uncoupled up there. Part of his train may be still blocking the main line. So you had to have that marker to make sure the train was complete.
So even technically a single locomotive with a marker is a train.
That's right. If he had a marker, yeah. All this stuff. Block signal. The block is basically, it's the area between two open stations. That mm-hmm. was a block. Then they came out with signals in part of it where they'd have a signal that would tell you. But I was trying to think of all this stuff. A train, an engine or more than one engine coupled, with or without car, displaying a marker or markers. That's what I said. Mm-hmm. I memorized this in 1953. You know what gave a train the right to operate on the tracks? A train had, there's three ways. It could have, it's in here somewhere if I can find it, but they had a right by their schedule in the timetable. They gave them a right. And then they had right by train order. They mm-hmm. could give a train order and say, this train has right over this train from here to there. That was absolute. Or a superintendent's bulletin could change this stuff in the timetable even. But in the timetable, okay, here it is. Train of superior right, a train given precedence by train order. Train of superior class, a train given precedence by timetable. First class trains have precedence over second class trains or that extra trains.
Passenger versus freight, basically.
Well, it didn't have to be a freight train could be a first-class train, too.
Okay.
You know, number eight could come through, and we could give him an order to display signals and run his first number eight. Then that freight train come right behind him and run a second number eight.
Oh, as a second section.
Yes, uh-huh. A train of superior direction. Northbound train superior to southbound train. So of the same class.
Whoever's coming southbound has to take the siding.
Right, unless he has a train order telling him not, that he don't have to, yeah. But I'm trying to remember... all these different definitions that I don't know. I haven't had to know that stuff for years.
You knew we were coming.
But
that's wonderful. I've learned a lot.
For many years, I loved working over at the depot. When we had a lot of people working, there was always something going on. Somebody pulling some kind of a joke on somebody. Somebody nailing somebody's dinner bucket to the counter, or you know, always something. You know, one day I took the guy's dinner bucket. He was a guy that he lives here in town now. But he was section hand, and he always ate a lot. Had a big dinner bucket, and it'd be racked sandwiches all the way across. And he'd come in at noon, he'd eat for an hour. And so one time I went out there to his dinner bucket, and it had the latches on it, and there's a place where I could stick a nail in through there and bend the nail. It had two latches, and I bent nails in both the latches of his dinner bucket. He come in there and grabbed that dinner bucket, and he went over and sat down. He went to open it, it wouldn't open. He ripped the latches off of his dinner bucket. I never told him for years that I was the one that done that.
I don't know, maybe we better keep that part out. He might find you.
I finally told him. But there was a lot of stuff going on it, and it was a lot of fun working. I enjoyed working.
I was going to ask if you had any odd experiences with passengers or people who bought tickets during the time you were selling.
I've had some experiences with passengers. I had one guy that used to ride regular. He was on the Coast Guard. And in the first place, anybody in service, we sold them tickets at a reduced rate. And so he'd ride to St. Louis, I think it was, and he was obnoxious. And he'd come in, and the train was way late. He'd ride number eight down, supposed to leave at 2:12 in the morning, and it'd be way late, going to be 6 o'clock in the morning. And, oh, the later it got, the madder he'd get, and he'd just faunch and rave and everything. He was totally obnoxious. One morning he was ranting and raving and getting pretty personal with me, like it was all my fault, you know. And it was in the wintertime. The train came from Minneapolis. There's a little bad weather up. And anyway, the section foreman, old Al Prossman, came in early. Always came in way early. And he was out there in the waiting room, and he heard this guy ranting and raving. And I left finally, because the train wasn't going to get there until after the next guy come on shift. So I left. And then after I left, old Al Prossman went out there, and he read the riot out to that guy. Oh, he really told him, you're riding for a reduced rate anyway, which you shouldn't. That reduced rate was for people, servicemen coming home or going back to duty on furlough and stuff. But we give the guy a break, you know. And Al really read him the riot act, you know.
Did you ever ride the Zephyr Rocket yourself?
Oh, yeah, before I ever hired out, when I went to telegraph school, that's the way I'd go to Minneapolis on it.
So you made that backup move in Burlington, where they had to switch from the Burlington to the Rock Island.
Oh, yeah, so huh.
That train had a headlight on the rear end because they had to pull forward, back up to connect to the Rock Island and then go north. So do you remember that?
I don't remember, because at that time I didn't know anything about railroading. All I knew was that it had two tracks and a train on it. I didn't. Mm-hmm. For years, I sold tickets on the California Zephyr, finest train in the United States. Mm-hmm. Sold many thousands of dollars worth of tickets and bragged that train up and bragged it up, and I'd never been on it. So finally one time, we were going to go out to Denver and going up Cheyenne, visit relation. And I got passes on the California Zephyr for the wife and I and one or two kids. I don't remember what we had then. Ride the California Zephyr from Burlington to Denver. So I got to see what I actually was telling people.
Right.
And then after that, I rode the California Zephyr and the Denver Zephyr and the Nebraska Zephyr.
Did you get to ride in the dome?
My daughter and I went up in the dome out there going into Denver. And we went through the car wash out there. Great big old brush. And everybody up there ducking.
Oh, great.
And then did you ride to the south, to St. Louis?
I can't remember that I ever rode south to St. Louis, no. Mm-hmm. Wife and I rode that number 41 that went from Hannibal to Chicago. We rode that thing from Fort Madison to Chicago one time and went up to watch a ball game. Cubs playing up there, and we'd never been up there. We got off a train up there. We didn't know where we were going, you know. We got up there, and I hailed a cab, and I told this cab, I said, we were just a little bit late, not bad, but it was after 11 o'clock, and the ball game started at 1. And I said, we want to go to the Cubs ball game, and I want to be there when the game starts. Can you get us there? He says, do you know anything about Chicago? And I said, no, never been here before. He says, well, the reason I ask you is you're going to think I'm taking you a long route, but he said, I'm taking the fast route. And we got in that cab, and I never had such a ride in my life. He took off, and he went around Michigan Boulevard out there, and it's traffic, 8 lanes each direction. And all of a sudden, he made a left-hand turn. Tires are squalling, horns are honking. And he turned off onto a little old side street, and we went down in a dip underneath another street, you know. And there's a car ahead of us, and he passed the car down in the bottom of this dip, got right up out of it, and made a right-hand turn right in front of that other car. Scared me. I was so scared, I was petrified. But we got the ball game on time. I wish you could have talked to Harry Fogland, because he was there a lot longer than I was. He was there for many years as a baggage agent, you know. Mm-hmm. And he saw a lot of things go on down at that depot, lots of them. Harry was kind of a funny old duck. If he liked you, you'd get along fine. If he didn't like you, he wouldn't even talk to you.
Did you ever go up into the up the stairs that lead to the upstairs?
Oh, yes, I've slept up there.
What did you sleep on?
They had cots up there. The engineers used them occasionally, you know, whenever it was too drunk to get anywhere else, why they'd go up there.
We have a story from a Wabash crewman who came in and was told to sleep up there, and there were no bunks. He slept on a cardboard mat on the floor, and the mice crawled around all night.
See, originally that was for Pullman personnel. The Pullman people would change trains there at Keokuk, and that was their bunk room. That's the story I've always heard, anyway. Uh-huh. And then, of course, the operators were out in that front room, but that was for the Pullman people.
Well, I guess it's had a number of different uses over the years.
Oh, yeah, probably has.
When we first cleaned out the depot, when the city took it over, it appeared that maybe there had been squatters sleeping up there, possibly.
I think there were things left in the small refrigerator that didn't smell very good.
Probably not. Yeah, oh yeah, I've slept up there several times, and then I used to have to go up there once in a while, engineer going to go to work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd have to go up and wake him up, you know, 1 o'clock or so. I've been up there a lot of times, yeah.
So engineers might have gone off duty in Keokuk and then gone back on
duty? Well, a lot of our engineers lived like down in Hannibal, and they would come up there, and some of them sleep in the depot up there. Some of them would drive it every day, but... And then I've been clear up in the attic up there. That was filthy. Oh,
easy to get up into, was it?
No. I think some of the old papers that I've got in a suitcase out there came from up there that I saved.
Those will be very interesting to take a look at.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're going to get a whole suitcase full of stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Now, I'm going to give you, I've got the two ticket daters that to stamp the tickets, to validate the tickets, and I've got both of them. There's a little plates on them says Union Depot, Keokuk, Iowa, and then you turn the wheels and set the date on them. And I've got two of them, but I'm going to donate both of them.
Fabulous.
I brought them home with me so nobody steal them.
Right.
I've also got, do you happen to have any that banker's sealing wax? It used to come in sticks about that big a square or that long. And you melt it. We used to send our money in on the trains. And you'd put it in an envelope. Then you put that envelope inside of this real stiff brown envelope, real hard, stiff paper, seal it, and then you take a sealing wax and you melt three spots of the sealing wax over where it overlapped there. That way, when it got to Chicago, that sealing wax, if the wax was broken, somebody might have got into it. But everybody that handled that, when I give that to the messenger on the train, he had to sign for it. And when he gave it to somebody else, they had to sign for it all the way. And I don't have any of that sealing wax. I wish I did, because I've got the stamp that you used to put in that. Every station that sent them, they had a stamp they put in. I've got the stamp. There's only one of them in the world. I was offered $385 for it. And there's one. It says Union Depot, Keokuk, Iowa.
Oh.
And I've got the only one in existence. You're going to get that.
Wonderful.
Did you and your wife live in Keokuk all this time?
No, we never did live in Keokuk. When I first went there, we were living in Nyota, I think. And then we moved down to Hamilton. And then we moved down here into Missouri in 1964. But I never did live in Keokuk.
So most of the time you were working, you were coming from Cahokia and Wayland.
Most of the time, yeah. Well, from 64 on. Before that, I lived in Hamilton for about a year, and then I lived up at Nyota. But I've got, it used to be when you copied a train order or you sent something on the telegraph, any business you did setting up that desk, you had a hook down here on fast to the leg of the table, a wire hook up there, and you stick it on that hook.
Oh, right. I've seen those.
Mm-hmm. At the end of your shift, you bundled all that up, tied it up, you know, and I've got that hook that hung on at the table leg. I've got that. I don't know what all I've got. But you're getting all that. And the train order hooks you talked about, I've got some train order hooks.
Wow.
In fact, I think I've got one or two of the ones with the big Y. Then I've got one that the handle of it, I think, has been broke off. Of the original type, it was a hoop, is what it was. It was a hoop of bamboo. Went up around like this. And down here, where it came back and joined on itself, there was like a mousetrap clip. And you put your orders in that, and you stand out there and you hand it up. And the conductor, the engineer, would take it, and he'd grab the orders out of it and give it a throw, and then you chase it down the track and go get it. And I've got one of them. And you're going to get all that stuff. And my telegraph set, the whole operating unit that I've got, you get all of it, including my bug. I've had that bug. I bought that while I was in telegraph school, 1953. And I paid $35 for it, which was a lot of money back then. It was used then. So I don't know how old it is. But it's chrome with the red bug on it. It's a beetle, and they always call it a bug.
Okay.
I'm going to give you all that stuff.
You said you went to Minneapolis for the school?
Gale Institute of Technology. They said it was a beautiful campus located on a lake. I get up there, road number 15 up there, rocket, got off a train, panhandlers standing all around up there wanting money. I'd never been in a place. I was a farm boy from Missouri. I'd never been in a place like that. I got up there, I was scared to death. And on the way up, I had met a boy from Fort Madison that was going up there too, Tommy Reichel. Anyway, got off a train today, we don't know where we're going, but we had instructions to go walk over so far and get on this streetcar with a trolley. And it'd take go up to West Lake Street. Okay, we did that. We got off and we found the school. It was a beautiful campus. It was a big old brick building sitting on West Lake Street.
Oh. False advertising.
But they would teach you, if you wanted to learn, they would teach you. They hired ex-dispatchers and chief dispatchers and stuff that knew the railroading. They hired a lot of them off the Great Northern. Retired guys off the Great Northern. And they knew, and you could learn if you wanted to. You started out to telegraph 6 words a minute. Well, maybe 3 you'd start with. Well, a word was 5 characters. Oh, that's just so slow. And you start out, you try to learn to memorize that, how that sounds and everything. And I thought, well, nobody learned this. Well, it didn't take long. You worked up from 6 words up to 10, went up to 10 and then to 15 and then to 20. And I think the 25, I think 30 words a minute was as high as you could go. That was the best, fastest class. Well, I was into that for a month before I got out of school. I just buzzed right to it. We had one guy up there that could not get 10 words a minute. He fought and fought, and he could not get it. They finally said, well, try 15. He went to 15 and picked it right up. There was a mental block or something. He could not get it. But they taught us accounting, basic accounting. Of course, every railroad was a little different. We were using Great Northern, but it was some different. And then every station had different reports to fill out, a different accounting. You never worked 2 jobs that were exactly alike. I could go to work at Montrose, relieve the agent for 2 weeks vacation, and go up to Weaver and relieve him, and it was two different, completely different stations. And I've done that. I've worked Montrose, I've worked Weaver, Fort Madison, Montrose, Keokuk, Alexandria, Canton, LaGrange, West Quincy. Now, on farther south than that, I've only worked, I think, Old Monroe was the only place that I worked down there. But I've worked Wayland, Cahokia, Lancaster, Downing, Cantrell, Milton.
So you worked over here when there were still tracks here.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. That was the old K&W.
I relieved the agent here.
When you first started, I keep thinking of new questions.
This is great.
When you first started, was there a lot of express?
Railway Express was big back then.
Uh-huh.
And the nice part of it is, the agent, or whoever handled the express, you know, the agent got 10% commission on express. And they sent me over to Lewistown, Illinois one time, which was off of my division, but they needed help, and work was slack over here, so I went over there to work. I had an aunt and uncle who lived up there 20 miles from there, so I'd stay with them. Anyway, I went up there to work. Well, they had a clerk there, and that clerk would come on duty like 5 o'clock in the morning, work from 5 to 1 or whatever, and then I wouldn't come in until, I don't know, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd walk in the door in the morning, the clerk say, well, you made $50 this morning. The train ran way early in the morning, like 5:30 and 6 o'clock in the morning. They would bring hatchery eggs up there for a hatchery, a turkey hatchery out of Van, Illinois. And they'd have a whole slug, a truckload of turkey eggs, all shipped by express.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'd come in, this clerk would figure up the charges, they'd give him a check. I never even saw them, but I was the agent, so I got the commission. Oh, yeah, and this happened several times, and I was making buku bucks over there. And so the last day I was there, I was going to leave. You know, the agent was coming back, and I got the money out of the till. I'm counting out the express commission, because you could take it cash right out of the till. And I'm counting out the express commission, and I made two piles. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm sorting this out. It's money out. He said, what for? I said, well, this is your pile, this is my pile.
Hmm.
Well, he says, nobody ever done that. He says, that's your money. He said, you don't have to give me nothing. He said, you're entitled to it. I said, no, I'm not. You done the work. Hmm. I said, I feel bad about splitting it with you. So I gave him half the money. He was a young guy, just starting a family and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him half the money. And I told him the day before, I said, now don't bring your lunch, because we're going out to eat. And we went to Hilda's Pantry, the best restaurant in Lewistown. And I went in there and I said, we want the two biggest and best steaks you've got and all that goes with it. And it was $3. Yeah, $3 a piece for a big, great big sirloin steak. You know? And then we had pie afterwards. Well, he said, nobody ever done it. He said, once in a while, somebody give me $20 or something. A lot of them didn't give me nothing. I couldn't do that.
So in Keokuk, there was not another express agent. You were...
No, we didn't handle it. They had their own agent, the express company. They were separate. They had down the lower end of the depot. And they had their own people. And loading and unloading on and off the trains, the express, they were supposed to handle that themselves. However, if I wasn't busy with, I'd help them with their express, you know, get the train on the road. In fact, the train's actually, passenger train, they had to wait for the mail till we got the mail loaded and unloaded. They had to do that, but express they didn't. And some of them old conductors say, get the express trucks out of the way, we're leaving. No, you're not. No, you don't leave till I give you this clearance Form A. You're not leaving yet. This express pays for this train. Your job depends on this express, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I'd help with the express a lot of times. I had one old express man. He kind of an old grouch. And I was out there, and I grabbed hold of the express truck, pulled upside the train, and I started putting stuff onto the car. He came up there and said, you don't work for express company? I said, no, just helping. He said, get the truck away from here. I said, you don't work for express company. I said, well, whatever you say. And I pulled the truck away from there, and I rode him up to the express company.
Hmm.
Only time in my life I ever rode anybody up.
Hmm.
I wrote that man up the express company. I said he would not let me help with the express. I'm trying to get your product, your business to move on that train. And that man got a bad reprimand, and I got an apology from the company and from him.
Hmm.
Oh, yes.
But, which rooms were they using for the express during that time? All of the downriver rooms or...
Yeah, the boiler room was at the very end. Then the express office was next.
I see.
And then the express freight room was the next one. The two big rooms down at the end. They were railway express. As I remember, there was two rooms down there. There was the express office, and then there was
the room. What was that little room that was upstairs in the downriver, that wooden enclosure? You go up the stairs to it?
See, I do remember that. And CB like that was the express company's record room. I believe they stored their records up there. But see, like if I was the agent out here at Cahokia or Wayland here, and you got you handled express business out here too, and you got the commission, 10% commission on it. Yeah, so it was just gravy. You was there anyway, mm-hmm. you know.
Then you mentioned there was a baggage man. How did he work? What did he?
The baggage man, he worked nights, and his job was to check baggage, handle all the baggage and the mail. Baggage and mail, that was his job, and all the janitor work.
So people, did they bring their luggage to that window?
Yes.
In the baggage room, and he handled it from there.
Uh-huh.
Saw that it got on the train with the right tags and all of that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and if he wasn't there, well, then me or whoever was there would have to handle it, but mm-hmm. I've handled a lot of it. They used to ship corpses, you know. Well, you could ship them either by baggage, check baggage, or you could ship by express, and the charge was the same. The charge was double the first-class passenger fare. That's what you charge for shipping a corpse. We had a corpse come in over there one night. It was bad. It was a military corpse, and they had an escort. Well, the escort rode the coach down there. Well, the train comes in town. All the family goes down there to meet the escort. I think he was a friend of the family or a friend or something. And they all go down to the end of the train where the coach was to meet this guy. And I'm up here way on up the platform, right up the upper end of the depot with a truck up there, and I'm going to unload this corpse. Me and the baggy man went to take it out of there, and there was juice running out of the bottom of that. They put the casket in a shipping box, you know, but it was leaking and stunk. It was bad. Luckily, the hearse was right there, backed up right there at the platform. I said, come on, guys. I said, get this thing loaded. Get it loaded now and get it out of here before this family gets up here. I never will forget that one. And then one night we had a corpse come in, and they knew it was coming in, but the funeral wasn't going to be until the next week or something. And it was coming in like on a Friday night or Saturday night, probably Saturday night. So the funeral home had told me that we'll come down and pick it up the next morning or whatever, you know. And I say, okay, no problem. So I unloaded the corpse, and I put it on the truck, and I backed it up in the baggage room up over along the wall. And it didn't bother me a bit, you know. I've handled a lot of them, and it didn't bother me a bit. Well, along the night, there were no trains coming for hours and hours, and I was tired. I was just wore out. And I'd like to lay down and take a nap. Well, where am I going to lay? And I spotted this nice flat box up on that baggage truck. So I got some old coats and put up there for a pillow, and I got up on top of that, and me and that guy both slept real good. People can't believe I would sleep on top of that shipping box of that corpse. He didn't bother me. And I don't think I bothered him. I can't think of all the stories and stuff that went on. One night, old Harry, baggage man, and I was sitting out on the baggage truck out there and underneath the canopy. And we didn't even know it, but there used to be an elevator down there across Bank Street. Big seed company down there, elevator. It was a real foggy night. It's so foggy you couldn't see nothing. Number 8 come across Johnson Street up there, and we couldn't see his headlights until after he got across Johnson Street. It was that bad. What we didn't know, that elevator burnt that night, and we sat on our platform and didn't even know it. We couldn't see it.
Yeah, I think we see it in some old pictures. A big, tall building on the river side of the tracks, right?
Yes. Yeah, and that thing burnt that night. We sat out there and didn't even know it. One night we were sitting out there, and we heard a terrible commotion. A lot of screeching and hollering and cussing. And here come a car up behind the depot, and got up there along the platform and stopped. And this gal jumped out of it, and she's in a nightgown, and she's barefooted, and she took off and run over across the tracks, and this guy's chasing her. And, they're just a fight. And I don't know whatever went on after that, but it was very exciting there for a few minutes. And how she run across that ballast on the tracks and stuff barefooted, I don't know, but she did.
I'd have had a bunch of people out there around going to get on a train or meet the train, you know. And had this young guy come in there, and he had a bunch of satchel things with him. He come up there, started talking, you know, and he said, you want to have some fun? I said, oh, well, you know, but for fun, you know. He said, I've got some recordings here. And he said, the train happened to be just a few minutes late, just a little bit late. And he said, you care if I go set this up and play a recording? I said, no, it sounds like fun. he set that thing up, and he had recorded trains whistling for a crossing or something for approaching a depot, and he played that recording. Boy, you could just hear this train off the distance and get closer and closer, blowing its whistle, and everything. You could hear it. And pretty soon, all that people drive their bags and all on the platform. Everybody wanted to be first, you know. And they all gathered up out there in the platform, and you could hear that train go, oh my.
We could listen to this for hours. This is wonderful.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you. We did too.
I don't know that I've told you anything that amounted to anything, you know.
Well, that's not the important thing. A lot of the details, a lot of the facts and figures, we already knew. But what's really important is to hear it the way you tell it.
And a lot of people haven't heard these stories before. And that's a major reason why we wanted to preserve them so that others can hear them. And hearing them straight from you is terrific.